All right. Now, cities are often said to be living, breathing beings. They grow, they change, they get sick, and they sometimes get very successful very quickly, sometimes at the expense of those who call it home. This is nothing unique in South Africa, but it's up to urbanists, city planners, bureaucrats, policymakers, and of course, activists from whom we hear quite regularly to take part in the process of making the spatial development something that is useful for everybody that is a part of the city. This is a very emotive topic and political. We've heard one side of the story quite regularly, and we hoped today to hear from the other side of the story. I'm joined in studio by David Daniels, the chairperson of the Municipal Planning Tribunal. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. You carry a great deal of, I suppose, responsibility considering the plans and the developments in the city from the perspective of economic growth, development, as well as the need for socio-economic advancement. And then Rob McGaffin, who is a town planner and land economist at the Urban Real Estate Research Unit, who joins me also in studio. You would have a really keen understanding of mostly, largely, I'm sure, the developers' perspectives, but not that doesn't mean not with a heart. So thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us here in studio. I hope maybe to kick off the panel by discussing, you know, the Harbour Arch development. Let's just start there. That's the one that's been in the papers and has really honed in our attention to this particular topic. David, if you can help me understand, one of the things that we heard from Difunukwazi, or at least their lawyers, was that they didn't feel comfortable with the fact that you were able to sign off this development without what they felt was an appropriate amount of social inclusion. Please help us understand the responsibilities that you expect from developers and some of the criteria that you look at when a development of that nature comes through.
Okay, maybe just a little bit about the Municipal Planning Tribunal.
With pleasure.
First, yeah. I think the idea with the establishment of the Municipal Planning Tribunal was to professionalize decision-making around town planning matters. So the city, in 2015, appointed 20-odd members to serve on this tribunal. 12 of them are officials of the city, and 8 are external town planners, town planners in private practice. I was retired and came onto the scene very late. The way in which the tribunal works is very structured. It's determined by legislation. Mm. And the key pieces of legislation are the Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act, which took effect from the 1st of July 2015. Province also has legislation called LUPA, Land Use Planning Act, and in the city adopted a bylaw, the Municipal Planning Bylaw. A very important part of the bylaw is a schedule at the end of the bylaw which deals with, it's called the DMS, the Development Management Scheme. Now, SPLUMA says the municipality must have a tribunal. The city, in its bylaw, has a whole section on the tribunal and how it must function. And it sets out the criteria for decision-making. So when we decide on an application, we first need to look at whether it meets the minimum threshold requirements. In other words,
the requirements of
the law. Does it fulfill the requirements of the bylaw? Because it doesn't, then it can't get over that hurdle. And then secondly, it must comply. Every municipality must have a spatial development framework, right? Does it comply with a spatial development framework? If it can't get past that section, then the tribunal cannot consider it further, and it must be referred back.
Mm.
Okay, so that's section 99(1) of the bylaw. I don't want to get into legal jargon. And then secondly, you have to consider the policies of the city, and the city has a whole raft of policies. So there's a policy about housing, about transport, the environment, and so on. So you need to consider all of those. Social development policy, economic development strategy, transport-oriented development strategy. You need to take those into account. And then very importantly, the third part has criteria which deals with what they call the extent of desirability. How desirable is this development? So it deals with things like socioeconomic impact. Is it compatible with what's around it? Impact on engineering services, the environment. And then once having considered all of those, can you impose conditions if you think it doesn't well, I don't want to use the phrase tick the boxes because it's not a tick box exercise. Mm. It's an exercise in planning judgment, yeah. So that comes to the harbour arch. So the, all of those things we need to take into account when you consider a major application like this.
I mean, please help us understand or disabuse us of maybe our ignorance here. You're speaking about conditions that could be placed. Let's speak about what the responsibilities are, for example, of the developers. Is it, this is not something that is mandated by law that they have to do, right?
No, look, I'd rather that you speak to maybe Rob or developers about that.
Sure.
I'd rather confine myself to what we take into consideration when we make decisions.
Correct. That's why I ask you. So when you speak about desirability, this is a recommendation rather than a legal requirement.
No. The criteria for desirability are spelled out in the law. So those things that I've just mentioned are part of the municipal planning bylaw.
Okay.
So you have to take into account environment, heritage, all of those things. And in the end, the decision that you take is a balance around all of these factors that you've taken into account.
Understood. I mean, I think the contention is not really about the full balance. There's a specific area in desirability that's raising emotions.
I understand that. Yeah.
Rob, maybe from an urban real estate research perspective, how well do we match up to global best practice?
In terms of what?
The legislation that Dave is describing.
I mean, I think there's been a huge improvement over the years with respect to the legislation. I mean, I think we have a much clearer framework, both at a national level, coming down to the provincial level and down to the local level. Funny enough, I'm actually just doing a little bit of work in Eastern Europe and looking at their legislation there. And ours is a lot simpler, clearer, better structured than what I saw there.
I mean, the reason I ask is that, you know, while gentrification is very much a global issue, you know, South Africa tends to hone in on it as if it's a very specific, as we sometimes call a financial apartheid that's being pushed out here. And do you feel as though we are legislatively and in terms of the decisions that have been made and the developments that we've seen appropriately applying global best practice to some of our unique circumstances? For example, the fact that the spatial planning already originally of Cape Town is quite hostile.
Look, I think gentrification is a global issue. And so it's not a legal issue, it's an economic issue. And hence, globally, it's an economic issue. It plays itself out in unique ways in different contexts, obviously. But it's driven by economic drivers. And so I don't think we're going to legislate our way out of that problem. We have to understand the underlying economics that's driving it. And I mean, I can speak to that.
I wanted to ask that next. Please do help us understand that. I mean, is it just the which is, I think, the commonly held view that developers just want to hold on to more profit, or is it actually a real cost to have to include non profitable or non economically viable projects within a development?
So two questions in a sense. I mean, the one with respect to gentrification, if I can just touch on that, and then I'll come back to but your point. You know, housing markets, there is no thing as one housing market, the Cape Town housing market. It doesn't exist. It's a collection of sub-markets, and they all interact with each other. And so what's happened with respect to the gentrification is that we haven't actually built enough middle and upper income houses in the right locations, which just seems like a bit of a strange thing to say in the context, right?
Right. What are the right locations too?
Whether it's, you know, the CBD and Green Points and all of those type of places in Cape Town. So what happened is prices in those areas have escalated sharply, which means middle income households. So my graduates can't afford, and these are highly educated people, cannot afford to get into those markets. And as a result, what happens is you then go and look for the next best option. And the next best option is Woodstock, Salt River, Maitland, Musenberg, etc. Go and look what's happened in the house prices in those suburbs, gone off the charts. So the scary thing for me is what's actually happened in the last 5 to 6 years is how many well-located existing affordable houses we've lost because they've filtered upwards as a result of these people looking for alternatives.
A great example would be the Book Up.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, so first of all, I have a client, excuse me, the listener asking whether you only have town planners on the tribunal or are there also urban designers and architects?
I think they're all town planners, land surveyors, but some of the town planners do have a whole lot of experience in urban design. So I think, I mean, planning is quite diverse in terms of the fields of expertise that it covers, you know, environment, transport, and so on. And I think all of the planners, I think all of the planners on the tribunal probably have more than 20, 30 years experience in town planning. So, yeah, okay. So we do cover the whole sort of ambit of the whole range of planning disciplines. Yeah.
I asked that because after our traffic, I'd like us to just touch on what Rob is outlining here, is that, you know, we never had the luxury in South Africa of a clean slate. You know, we had to start with quite entrenched economic as well as physical infrastructure that we're working with. And so I'd love to understand how that town planning experience without the architects and the like also help us solve this housing problem in the main. It's housing.
So what's happened with respect to the gentrification is that we haven't actually built enough middle and upper income houses in the right locations, which just seems like a bit of a strange thing to say in the context, right?
Right. What are the right locations?
Whether it's, you know, the CBD and Greenpoints and all of those type of places in Cape Town. So what happened is prices in those areas have escalated sharply, which means middle income households. So my graduates can't afford, and these are highly educated people, cannot afford to get into those markets. And as a result, what happens is you then go and look for the next best option. And the next best option is Woodstock, Salt River, Maitland, Musenberg, etc. Mm-hmm. Go and look what's happened in the house prices in those suburbs, gone off the charts. So the scary thing for me is what's actually happened in the last 5 to 6 years is how many well-located existing affordable houses we've lost because they've filtered upwards as a result of these people looking for alternatives.
A great example would be the Book Up.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, so first of all, I have a client, the listener asking whether you only have town planners on the tribunal or are they also urban designers and architects?
I think they're all town planners, land surveyors, but some of the town planners do have a whole lot of experience in urban design. So I think, I mean, planning is quite diverse in terms of the fields of expertise that it covers, you know, environment, transport, and so on. And I think all of the planners, on the tribunal probably have more than 20, 30 years experience in town planning. So, yeah, okay. So we do cover the whole sort of ambit of the whole range of planning disciplines. Yeah.
I asked that because after our traffic, I'd like us to just touch on what Rob is outlining here, is that, you know, we never had the luxury in South Africa of a clean slate. You know, we had to start with quite entrenched economic as well as physical infrastructure that we're working with. And so I'd love to understand how that town planning experience without the architects and the like also help us solve this housing problem in the main. It's housing.
Join the conversation.
Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
All right, welcome back to it. It's the Wednesday panel. Today we're speaking spatial development. I'm joined in studio by David Daniels, who is the chairperson of the Municipal Planning Tribunal. Thank you so much for joining us. Yeah, and Rob McGaffin, who happens to be a town planner and land economist with the UCT Nedbank Urban Real Estate Research Unit. And I have a couple of questions that I'm going to pass on to you guys. Thank you for sending them in, and please continue to. So one of the questions here is South Africa town planning does not address sprawl. We must start more flats, apartment buildings to address population growth. Now, this was something that you were kind of speaking to before the break, Rob, and why I was asking about the Municipal Tribunal. And the reason I'm asking is, so we have the data, we have these intelligent town planners and urban developers. Whose job is it to provide room from a social development person to push back against this global phenomenon, which is economic advancement will turn into great gentrification?
Can I speak to the sprawl issue and you can speak to the housing issue?
You're getting to choose the questions you answer. Which is like,
yeah, I also wanted to make a comment on this whole issue of spatial justice, because I think that is one of the big criticisms from some of the objectors, particularly to the Harbour Arch development. The spatial justice is a very important principle, and I found it quite fascinating that people try to lecture the tribunal on spatial justice when, I mean, I'm a victim of group areas, so right. I'm very sensitive about this particular. In Spluma, where it talks about spatial justice, it refers 3 times to the upgrade of informal settlements. I think that should be the main focus. I think it'd be great if a developer builds a multi-story building in the city, sets aside some units for poor people. But my biggest concern about the city of Cape Town and town planning is that we have this massive pocket of poverty in the metro southeast. That's the heart of the metropole. The CBD is off-center to the metro. So what we need to do is to establish new nodes on the Cape Flats to take jobs, economic opportunities, better education opportunities to where the people are. To me, that is fundamentally what spatial justice is about. With regard to sprawl, it's interesting that one of the most controversial policies of the city, particularly in the leafy suburbs, is this whole issue of densification. We were told at a meeting the other day that this is going to cause a war, this preoccupation of the city with higher densities. The city, I think, is committed to the right cause here, that sprawling cities are inefficient cities. So we need to compact around nodes, around railway stations, transport interchanges, etc., etc. So I think it's absolutely on the right track. The city is inefficient. We've developed services in the suburbs that can serve much higher densities of people, and we have to do that. You also create higher thresholds for economic and other activities, 100. You see.
I'm with you, David, but then that brings us squarely back to the question of whose job is it? So whose job is it to improve the informal settlement? And when I say improve, turn them formal, not just upgrade. And whose job is it to ensure that these transport systems and attracting the nodes of particular economic activity occur? Please go ahead, Rob.
Thanks, Rita. But I'd like to just add on to that, if I can. Sorry, if you put two planners in a room and discuss these type of things, you're in for a ride.
You guys aren't disagreeing. Like, this is not what panels are.
No, but I think what's important is that this discussion around affordable housing and sprawl and urban efficiency are completely linked, because we do have to increase our thresholds, densities, or to put it simply, numbers of houses per hectare.
Okay.
Right? So to give you an idea, roughly global norm is you need about 50 houses per hectare to make public transport work.
Okay.
It's a broad number, that, etc. We're sitting at about 15.
Okay.
Right. So we're completely out of the ballpark. So we have to densify up. But we don't have enough middle and upper income households to densify using them. So we have to look to affordable housing to increase the densities in the city, to make it more efficient, to make it more equitable, to make it more environmentally sustainable, etc., etc. So these two things are completely tied together. The last point on the spatial justice is what I think also, you know, spatial justice is about access. It's about access to opportunities, right? And so what I think needs to come into the conversation is about transport and transport systems as well. Because a place is poorly located because people can't access other things. So I think, yes, we do need to look at the housing issue. We do need to look at decentralizing economic opportunities, etc. But if we improve the transport system, a lot of the areas in Cape Town wouldn't be as badly located as they are.
Indeed, but you know, as many have noted, people spend something like 2/3 of their salary getting to work, right? But my concern here is again the roles that each of your organization have to play in making that happen and incentivizing, because the incentivization when we're speaking about justice can't be purely profit.
Absolutely.
And so, how is it that on the tribunal, for example, you encourage developers to develop closer? Because right now we're speaking the buildings as opposed to the transport, that people develop closer to hubs where that might be a little bit more dense, the improvement of those places. And then finally, I don't want to give you a mandate you don't need, that is not yours, but I understand process obviously extended a little bit more control to the province with respect to rail. Is that something that they involve you with?
No, not at all. Yeah.
All right. They should probably, I mean, in terms of planning routes, it would help to know where. But anyway, go ahead and answer.
So, I mean, to come back to your question, who is responsible? And I think any development, right? I mean, if you build a development, we have to live with it for the next 50 years. That's but the nature of it, et cetera. And so you have to look at a broad range of objectives that development needs to achieve. And those are social, they're economic, environmental, etc. However, if a development is not financially feasible in the first place, well, all those other conversations are moot because it's never going to take place.
Right.
So you got to actually start with looking at the financial viability of a development, etc. And once that stacks up, you can then start having another conversation about a lot of the other objectives that it needs to meet. Right. Now, I'm not talking about super profits. I'm just saying viable. You can pay the money back to the bank that you've borrowed, is basically, to put it bluntly. Right?
So I'm empathetic to that in terms of the cycles we face for developers. I mean, how big is that margin? You know, in terms of being able to have room, not necessarily the profit margin, but the margin for being able to have other considerations.
In this current market, quite slim.
Wow.
I think that's where a little bit of the misnomer comes in. And I think that's, for me, I'm not opposed to inclusionary housing per se, etc. But I think it's based on some quite shaky premises and assumptions.
Okay.
There's this underlying assumption that there are these huge profits being made, huge amounts of money that's available to cross-subsidize these bit developments. The reality is that is not true. If you go and look at actual profitabilities on vast majorities of bit developments, it's very difficult to make a development viable at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's playing itself out. I mean, if you look at, you know, you look at residential property, it represents, if you look at listed funds on the Joburg Stock Exchange, it represents about 3%, if that. Less. In fact, it's less.
Right.
Right. So if it was making so much money, believe me, a lot more investors would be interested in it. So that's the one problem that I think is in place, that there's this idea that there are these super profits that are being made. Your second question was then, but, you know, again, or part of the question is, who is responsible?
Mm.
And I look at this in quite a simple way. I call it what I call it the value versus cost challenge. No bit developer, in fact, and when I say bit developer, there's another misnomer. People have this idea that bit developers drive 4x4s and live in Camps Bay. Yeah. People who extend their houses, who build a room in the back of their house, who do something, they are developers as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we got to get out. We have this sort of notional developer idea. And I think that's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. There's a range of developers out there. And all of us would never look at doing a development if what we could sell it for or rent it out for is less than what it cost us to build it,
right?
So it's a very simple equation there. The problem in Cape Town and in South Africa is that the value of a building is curtailed by what people can pay for it, right? And that's a function of people's incomes, et cetera, and we know we've got high unemployment rates, low incomes, et cetera, so that's fairly sort of, you can't change that.
Right.
So the other side of the equation you have to go to is the cost side, right? Because we've got to try and bring the cost down, the drivers of housing down, the drivers of the cost down, right? And a lot of those do sit in the public realm.
Yeah.
Because if you look at it, it's what I call the land production process, right? Getting a piece of land to the point where you can put a brick in the ground. And really, that's got three components. You've got to access the land in the first place. You've got to have infrastructure you can tap into.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to have the bit development rights.
All right.
So on all three of those, if I can just say, huge amounts of underutilized public land throughout this city, not just municipal, right? I'm going to province, SOEs, etc. I mean, we really need military air force bases 5 kilometers from the CBD. Do we need to have half vacant Transnet warehouses between the CBD and Salt River? Infrastructure, larger state driven but responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then the development process. We've just done some research recently. To get a development off the ground, it's taking between 5 and 8 years.
Right.
Now, for every year you delay a project, we've done some rough estimates. You decrease the affordability by 15%.
Okay. I want us to pick up on this after our EWN headline.